To the ill and struggling, even wholesome food can be unpleasant, and friends and relatives can seem burdensome. They often aren't recognized, but are instead considered nuisances. Similar to this is the condition of people who are perishing in their souls. They aren't aware of the things that lead to salvation, and view those who worry about them as bothersome. This occurs not because of the nature of the situation, but due to their spiritual illness, like the mentally unwell who despise those who take care of them and even insult them. So it is with non-believers as well. But like how those who are insulted by the mentally ill continue to show them compassion and sorrow, considering this hostility as the worst symptom of their severe disorder when they can't recognize their closest friends, so should we behave towards non-believers. In fact, we should mourn for them more than for our spouses, because they don't know about the universal salvation. For we should love all people more than a man loves his wife, and aim to lead them to salvation, regardless of their backgrounds. Therefore, let us weep for them, for the word of the cross is considered foolishness to them, despite it being wisdom and power itself. As it is stated, the word of the cross to those that perish is foolishness. The message of the cross is seen as foolishness by those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will annihilate the wisdom of the wise, and the intelligence of the intelligent will I dismiss. Where is the wise one? Where is the scholar? Where is the debater of the world? For, as it was probable that the Greeks would ridicule the cross, and they would react and argue with the wisdom they believed came from themselves, feeling disturbed by the Greeks' ridicule, Paul reassures them and says, do not consider it strange or inexplicable what is happening. This is the nature of the matter. Its power is not understood by those who perish, for they are out of their minds and behave like lunatics. Therefore, they mock and are repulsed by the remedies that bring health. And why do I speak of God? Because in relation to created things, if we try this, great mockery will follow. Consider a man who tries to define everything by logic. Let him try to understand through your words how we see light. Try to persuade him by logical argument. But you cannot. Because if you say that simply opening the eyes is sufficient to see, you have not explained the method, only the fact. For why do we not see by our hearing and hear with our eyes, and why do we not hear with our noses and smell with our ears? If this man is uncertain about these things and we cannot provide an explanation while he is laughing, should we not mock him more? Since both senses originate from the same brain and the two organs are neighbors to each other, why can't they perform the same function? We will not be able to justify or explain the incredible and fascinating functioning. If we try, we risk being ridiculed. Therefore, let's leave this to God's power and limitless wisdom and stay silent. 2. But what do you say, O man? Christ became a slave for you, having taken the form of a slave, Phil 2.7, and was crucified and rose again. And when you should, for this reason, worship him risen and admire his love, because what neither father nor friend nor son did for you, all this the Lord did for you, the enemy and offender, when I say you should admire him for these things, do you call that foolishness which is full of so great wisdom? Well, it is nothing surprising, for it's a sign of those who perish not to recognize the things which lead to salvation. Don't be troubled, therefore, for it's neither strange nor inexplicable that things truly great are ridiculed by those who are beside themselves. Now, you can't convince those who think like this using human wisdom. In fact, if you try to convince them this way, you're just doing the opposite. For the things that go beyond reasoning require faith alone. Therefore, should we attempt to convince people with reasoning how God became man and entered into the virgin's womb and not leave the matter to faith, they will only scoff more. Therefore, those who seek through reasoning are indeed those who perish. Just the same with regards to God's matters. If we try to explain them using external wisdom, great mockery will follow, not due to their weakness, but due to human foolishness. For the vast and important things no language can truly explain. 3. Now consider, when I say, he was crucified, the Greek questions, and how can this make sense? He didn't even save himself while being crucified and facing extreme suffering during the crucifixion. So how then, after all of that, did he rise again and assist others? If he had had the power, it would have been more appropriate before death. This is what the Jews actually said. St. Matt assist 41:42. But if he couldn't assist himself, how could he assist others? There's no logic in it, he states. You're right, O man, for indeed it goes beyond logic. The power of the cross is unspeakable. The fact that he was amidst horrors, yet showed himself to be above all horrors, and being in the enemy's grip, still managed to triumph, this shows infinite power. Just like in the case of the three children, it wouldn't have been as amazing if they hadn't entered the furnace, but the fact that they walked into it and overcame the fire is more astonishing. And in the case of Jonah, it was a greater feat after he had been swallowed by the fish to not be harmed by the creature than if he had never been swallowed at all. So too in regard to Christ. His not dying wouldn't have been as incredible as the fact that having died, he broke the chains of death. Don't ask, then, why didn't he save himself on the cross, for he was racing towards the final battle with death itself. See Hooker EPV 48, 9. He didn't descend from the cross, not because he couldn't, but because he chose not to. If the power of death couldn't restrain him, how could the nails of the cross? 4. But these things, although known to us, are not yet understood by the unbelievers. That's why it was said, the word of the cross is considered foolishness by those who are perishing, but to us who are saved, it is the power of God. As it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and reject the prudence of the prudent. Up to this point, he asserts nothing from himself that might be offensive. He first relies on the testimony of the Scripture, and then, armed with the confidence from it, he uses more forceful language and says, 1 Cor 1:2, 0:21, verses 20:21. Hasn't God made the wisdom of this world look foolish? Where's the so-called smart guy? Where's the scholarly expert? Where's the world's great debater? Hasn't God made earthly wisdom seem foolish? Because even though in God's wisdom the world didn't know him through its own wisdom, God was pleased to save those who believe through the perceived foolishness of preaching. After stating, "It is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise," he supports this with evidence, asking, "Where's the wise person? Where's the scholar?" This refers to both Gentiles and Jews, because what kind of philosopher, who among those skilled in logical argument, who among those well-versed in Jewish matters, has saved us and revealed the truth? No one. In fact, it was all done by a fisherman. After reaching his intended conclusion, deflating their arrogance and saying, "Hasn't God made the wisdom of this world foolish?" he also gives the reason for why things are the way they are. For in the wisdom of God, he says, the world through its wisdom didn't recognize God. Hence the cross was revealed. Now what does "in the wisdom of God" signifies? The wisdom reflected in those works through which he intended to reveal himself. For he created them and made them as they are so that through the visible things admiration for the Creator could be learned. Is the heaven immense and the earth limitless? Marvel then at him who made them. For this immense heaven was not only made by him, but was made effortlessly. Similarly, the infinite earth came into existence as if it was non-existent. That's why he said about the former, "The works of your hands are the heavens," and about the earth, "Who has made the earth as if it were nothing." Since the world, through its wisdom, didn't want to discover God, he used what seemed foolish, that is, the gospel, to persuade people through faith and not reasoning. It follows then that where there's God's wisdom, man's wisdom is no longer needed. Before, through human wisdom, we inferred that he who created the world like this and so great must indeed have extraordinary, indescribable power, and we understood him this way. But now we need neither reasoning nor wisdom, only faith. To believe in him who was crucified and buried, to confidently believe that this same person resurrected and ascended, doesn't require wisdom or reasoning, but faith. The apostles themselves didn't enter through wisdom, but faith, and exceeded the wisdom and loftiness of the pagans. And this is far greater, as it is less to raise questions than to accept God's mystery through faith, surpassing all human understanding. But how did he destroy wisdom? It was revealed to us by Paul and others like him that he proved wisdom to be unbeneficial. When it comes to accepting the gospel message, neither does wisdom benefit the wise, nor does ignorance harm the unlearned. If one might say something even surprising, ignorance rather than wisdom is a more fitting state to receive this message and is more easily manageable. The shepherd and the rural person will more rapidly embrace this, putting aside any doubts and committing fully to the Lord. Thus, in this way, he destroyed wisdom. Because once wisdom declined initially, it became forever worthless. So when wisdom should have exhibited its true abilities and witnessed the Lord through deeds, it did not. Hence, even if wisdom now wishes to assert itself, it cannot. For this method of knowing God is far superior to the other. So you see, faith and simplicity are necessary, and we should pursue this everywhere, prioritizing it over worldly wisdom. For God, as he says, made wisdom foolish. But what does "he has made foolish" mean? He has shown it to be foolish in terms of accepting the faith. Because they were proud of it, he quickly exposed it. For what kind of wisdom is it when it cannot identify the most important of the good things? He therefore made her appear foolish after she had first admitted it herself. For if she proved nothing when discoveries could have been made by logic, how will she be able to achieve anything now, when things are on a larger scale? Now, when only faith is needed and not sharpness of mind. You see, then, God has shown her to be foolish. It was his joy also to save through what some see as the foolishness of the gospel. Foolishness, I stress, not actual, but perceived to be such. For what's even more remarkable is his triumph by introducing not another superior wisdom, but what appeared to be foolishness. He ousted Plato, for instance, not by using another more skilled philosopher, but by an uneducated fisherman. Thus the loss was more substantial and the victory more magnificent. The significance of the things being said here is vast, for he is suggesting how God has triumphed through opposites and how the gospel is not human-made. What he is saying goes something like this. When we tell the Jews to believe, their response is to demand proof like raising the dead, healing those possessed, showing them signs. But instead, what do we say? We say that the one we preach about was crucified and died. This could not only fail to convince those reluctant to believe, but it could even drive away those who are willing. However, it doesn't drive people away, rather it draws them in, securing their faith and achieving victory. 1 Corinthians 1.22, 24, verses 22, 24. Next, to demonstrate the power of the cross, he says, "For Jews ask for signs and Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God." Again, the Greeks demand from us a sophisticated style and sharp-witted debate. But we preach the cross to them as well, that which for the Jews seemed to be a sign of weakness, for the Greeks is seen as foolishness. Therefore, when we not only fail to deliver what they demand, but also present the very opposite of their demand, for the cross not only does not seem to be a concept derived from rational reasoning, but it even seems to be the complete negation of a concept, not seen as a proof of power, but as an admission of weakness. Not a display of wisdom, but a hint of foolishness. When, therefore, those who are seeking signs and wisdom not only do not receive what they ask for, but even hear the opposite of what they desire and then are convinced by these opposites, isn't the power of him who is preached indescribable? It's like if someone lost at sea longing for a harbor, you show not a safe haven but a wilder part of the ocean, and yet you manage to make him follow gratefully. Or like a doctor attracting a wounded patient in need of remedies by promising to heal him, not with medicine, but by burning him again. Surely this is a sign of tremendous power. Just like that, the apostles prevailed, not just without a sign, but by something that seemed to contradict all known signs. This is also what Jesus did in the case of the blind man. When he healed him, he removed the blindness by using something that exacerbated it, clay, St. John enters 6. So as he healed the blind man using clay, he also brought the world to him using the cross. This was surely adding an offense, not removing one. He did the same thing in creation, accomplishing things through their opposites. For example, he confined the sea with sand, making the weak a bridle to the strong. He placed the earth upon water, ensuring that the heavy and dense would be carried by the soft and liquid. Likewise, through the prophets with a small piece of wood, he raised iron from the bottom, 2 Kings Vaganters 5, 7. In the same way he has drawn the world to himself with the cross, as the water bears up the earth, so the cross carries the world. You see now it shows tremendous power and wisdom to convince using things that contradicts us. Therefore, even though the cross appears to be offensive, far from causing offense, it attracts. Verse 25. With all these things in mind, Paul, in utter awe, proclaimed that God's foolishness is wiser than men, and God's weakness is stronger than men. This was in reference to the cross. He was talking about a perceived foolishness and weakness, not a real one. He was responding to the opinions of the other party. What the philosophers could not achieve through reasoning, this perceived foolishness did remarkably well. Who then is wiser? The one who persuades many, or the one who persuades few or nobody at all? The one who convinces people about the most important subjects or about irrelevant matters? How hard did Plato and his followers work, giving us talks about a line, an angle, a point, and about even and odd numbers, equal and unequal, and other such trivial matters? These discussions are as useless to life as spiderwebs. None of these talks ever helped anyone significantly. That's how he ended his life. He struggled so much to prove that the soul was immortal. Yet he departed as he came, without saying anything definite or convincing any listener. However, the cross, through unlearned men, convinced even the entire world, and not just about ordinary things, but in conversations about God, the truth of godliness, the evangelical lifestyle, and the judgment of the afterlife. And it turned everybody, even the uneducated, into philosophers. That's how God's foolishness is wiser than men, and God's weakness is stronger. How is it stronger? Because it spread across the entire world, and everyone was completely taken by it. While thousands were trying to obliterate the name of Jesus, the opposite happened. His name prospered and grew stronger, but they wasted away and perished. Living people who fought against the crucified had no power. Notably, when a Greek calls me a fool, he shows himself to be extremely foolish. I, who he considers a fool, clearly appear to be wiser than the wise. When he calls me weak, he shows himself to be weaker. For the noble things that tax collectors and fishermen could do by the grace of God, these philosophers, rhetoricians, tyrants, and indeed the entire world, running in thousands of directions, could not fathom. And what did the cross not introduce? The doctrine about the immortality of the soul, the resurrection of the body, the contempt of the present things, the desire for future things. Indeed, it turned men into angels, leading everyone, everywhere, to practice self-denial and demonstrate all forms of courage. 8. The fact that the gospel is divine is evident from this. Namely, how could it have occurred to 12 uneducated men to attempt such monumental tasks? They lived in marshes, rivers, and deserts, and possibly never entered a city or a marketplace. So how did the idea occur to them to stand against the entire world? The evidence of their fear and lack of courage is shown in the writings about them, without any attempt to apologize or hide their faults. This reality in itself is a remarkable sign of the truth. So, what does the text say about them? When Christ was captured, after countless miracles, they fled. The one who stayed, the leader of them all, denied knowing him. How then did they, who couldn't withstand the Jews' attack when Christ was alive, take a stand against the whole world after he had died and was buried, and supposedly had not risen again, nor given them encouragement or infused courage in them? Wouldn't they have asked themselves, what's the meaning of all this? He couldn't save himself. How will he protect us? He didn't defend himself while alive. Will he now extend a helping hand to us now that he is dead? He, while alive, didn't conquer even one nation, and are we expected to convince the entire world just by mentioning his name? How, I ask, could all this be logical, not just as an action, but even as a thought? Hence, it's clear that had they not seen him after he had risen and received compelling proof of his power, they would not have taken on such a significant challenge. 7. But among them too, it will be acknowledged, many have shown a disregard for death. Tell me who? Was it he who drank the hemlock? But if you wish, I can point out 10,000 such individuals within the church. If it would have been permissible for them to drink hemlock and pass away when persecuted, all would have become more renowned than he. Moreover, he drank when he was not given the option to drink or not to. Whether he wanted to or not, he had to experience it, which is not a reflection of bravery, but rather of necessity, and nothing more. As even thieves and murderers, having been found guilty by their judges, have endured harsher conditions. But in our case, the situation is entirely different. The martyrs did not suffer against their will, but by their own choice, despite having the freedom to avoid suffering, exhibiting a level of courage tougher than any gemstone. Therefore, you see, it's hardly impressive that the person I was mentioning drank hemlock. It was beyond his control to refrain from drinking, especially when he had reached such an advanced age. He claimed to disregard life when he declared himself to be 70 years old. Yet can this be considered as disregarding life? I personally could not assert this, and neither can anyone else. But show me someone remaining steadfast in torments for the sake of piety, as I present you with 10,000 such individuals all over the world, who bravely endured while their nails were being torn out, who remained strong while their body's joints were being pulled apart, who stood their ground while their body was being dismembered bit by bit, or their head, who endured while their bones were forced out by levers, who persisted while continuously placed on frying pans, who endured being thrown into a cauldron. Show me these examples, for to die by hemlock is the equivalent to a man remaining in a state of sleep. In fact, this type of death is said to be even more pleasant than sleep. But if some did endure torments, their honor is now lost. For they perished under dishonorable circumstances, some for revealing secrets, and some for striving to gain power, while others were exposed in the most heinous crimes, yet others senselessly, fruitlessly, and foolishly killed themselves with no apparent cause. However, this isn't the case with us. That's why nothing is said about the actions of those individuals. But our examples of courage continue to thrive and grow day by day. Paul had this in mind when he said, "The weakness of God is stronger than all men." 9. Even if they had countless friends, wouldn't they have quickly turned them all into enemies by disrupting age-old customs and moving their father's boundaries? However, as it stands, they had everyone as enemies, both their own people and foreigners. Even if everything about their outer appearances had commanded respect, wouldn't everyone hate them for ushering a new political order? As it was, they lacked in every aspect, and it was likely that because of this glaring deficiency, everyone would instantly despise and ridicule them. So who would you mention? The Jews? They harbored an unspeakable hatred toward them because of what had been done to the master. The Greeks? Firstly, they radically dismissed someone not beneath them, and none knew this better than the Greeks. Plato wanted to formulate a new system of governance, or rather a fragment of it, not by altering religious customs, but simply by proposing a different approach to behavior. However, he was expelled from Sicily and narrowly escaped death. Only his freedom was forfeited, not his life. Had it not been for a barbarian friendlier than the Sicilian despot, Plato would have faced lifelong slavery in foreign lands. Nonetheless, messing with governance isn't the same as meddling with religious beliefs. The latter is more disruptive and unsettling for people. Saying, "Let a particular person marry another, or let the protectors of the people perform their duties in a specific way," won't stir much chaos, especially when such ideas are documented in a book with no dire need from the legislator to push for their implementation. On the other hand, declaring, "The gods people worship are not gods but demons, he who was crucified is God," unquestionably sparked an immense outcry, leading to grave repercussions and igniting a war. For Protagoras, who was one of them, daring to say, "I know of no gods," not traveling the world to announce it, but in just one city, was in serious danger for his life. And Diagoras the Milesian and Theodorus, who were known as atheists even though they had friends and the type of influence that comes from being eloquent and were admired for their philosophical beliefs, yet none of these things helped them. And the great Socrates, who was the most philosophical among them, drank hemlock for this reason, because in his talks about the gods he was suspected of deviating slightly from the norm. If the mere suspicion of change brought such great danger upon philosophers and wise men and those who had obtained limitless popularity, And if they were not only incapable of doing what they wanted, but were also banished from their life and country, how can you not be in awe and astonishment when you see that the fisherman has had such an impact on the world and achieved his goals, has conquered all, both barbarians and Greeks? 10. But it's argued that they didn't introduce foreign gods like the others did. Interestingly, the very aspect that is most surprising is their dual innovation of both overthrowing existing beliefs and introducing the crucified one. One must wonder, how did such notions come into their minds? What made them so certain about their cause? Which of their predecessors had they observed prospering with similar intents? Wasn't everyone worshipping demons? Were people not making divine beings out of elements? Wasn't the only difference found in forms of impiety? Yet they challenged everything, overthrew everything, and quickly spread throughout the world as if they were winged creatures. They disregarded dangers, death, the enormity of the task, their small numbers, the vast amount of opposition, and the authority, power, and wisdom of those fighting against them. Because they had a greater ally, the power of the one who was crucified and resurrected. It wouldn't have been as spectacular if they had literally chosen to wage war with the world, because they could have directly opposed their enemies, taken up hostile territory, and organized themselves accordingly. But this wasn't the case. They had no specific camp, but were among their enemies, in this way overcoming them. Within the throng of their enemies, they evaded capture and came out superior, attaining a significant victory, a victory that fulfills the prophecy that says, "You have dominion even among your foes." Psalm 110:2. The most astonishing aspect was that despite their enemies subduing them, imprisoning them, and chaining them, they were not only undefeated, but also succeeded in making their oppressors bow down to them. The whippers were whipped, those who bound were bound, and the persecutors submitted to the fled. We can tell these stories to the Greeks and even more, for there's an abundance of truth, and if you follow this discussion, we can teach you the entire strategy against them. For now, let's cling to two main points. How did the weak conquer the strong? And where did they get the idea, given their state, to devise such plans if they weren't assisted by divine help? In the meantime, cling to the things that have been said and join me in the struggle, attracting others to us and influencing them through the way we live. As I always say, anyone who teaches high standards of behavior should first live by them themselves, becoming indispensable to those who listen. So let's strive to be like that and win the goodwill of the Greeks. And we can achieve this if we not only refrain from doing wrong, but also endure it. Consider how, when little children carried in their father's arms hit their fathers, how lovingly the father lets the child vent his anger, and then when he sees that the child is done, how his expression lightens. Similarly, let's behave, and as parents with their children, let's interact with the Greeks, since all the Greeks are like children. In fact, some of their own people say that Greeks are forever children and no Greek is ever old. Just like children, they don't want to consider anything useful. The Greeks, too, like to continuously play, wallowing in physical and emotional debasement. Additionally, much like children often disregard serious discussions and instead laugh, Greeks too laugh when we talk about the kingdom. As a child's drool often spoils their food and drink, similarly, the words of the Greeks, null and unclean, spoil their minds. Even when we are giving children what they really need, they trouble the providers with evil words, and we must tolerate this. Similarly, when they see a thief making away with their property, children don't resist. They might even smile at the intruder. But take away their toys or anything small belonging to them, and they feel it deeply, throw tantrums and stomp their feet. So too with the Greeks. When they see the devil stealing all their wealth, even their lives, they laugh and see him as a friend. But should anyone take away their wealth or anything trivial, they cry and, like children, throw tantrums. And just like children innocently expose their body parts without feeling embarrassed, the Greeks engage in prostitution and adultery, revealing their natural instincts and indulging in forbidden relationships without any sense of shame. So far, that's what we had to say. But let us demonstrate all the virtues through our actions and strongly ignite the flame of virtue. Because you are lights, he says, shining in the middle of the world. And each of us has been given a much greater responsibility by God than the sun, greater than the heaven, earth, and sea, as much greater as spiritual things are superior to physical things. So when we look at the sun and admire its beauty and the brightness, let's remember that the light within us is even better and greater, as surely the darkness is more terrifying if we're not careful. Indeed, a deep darkness covers the entire world. This is what we need to dispel and dissolve. It's not just night among the heretics and the Greeks, but also among our own people, in regard to beliefs and way of life. For many completely deny the resurrection, many fortify themselves with their horoscope, many cling to superstitious practices, including omens, auguries, and predictions. Some also use amulets and charms, but we will address these issues later once we've finished addressing the Greeks. You have given me passionate applause and recognition, but with all your applause, beware lest you be among those of whom these things are said. Therefore, I beseech you all to become mature, since as long as we are children, how shall we teach them how to be mature? How shall we prevent them from childish foolishness? Let us therefore become mature, that we may reach the measure of the stature which has been marked out for us by Christ, and may acquire the good things to come, through the grace and loving kindness, etc., etc.